Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, earlier this week, we gave some kudos to John Boehner for what we thought was a very strong speech up at the Economic Club of New York, saying we're going to have to cut trillions, not just billions, if you want House Republicans to go along with raising the debt ceiling. Now, that was one marker earlier in the week. Now, Pat Toomey, one of your favorites, I know, one of mine certainly as well, and a National Review favorite, laying down another marker. And he said this before, but I think it's getting a little more attention as we get closer to the vote, and that's that we don't really necessarily have to raise the debt ceiling. This idea that there's a drop-dead deadline of August 2nd or whatever Tim Geithner has recently said is not necessarily the case. Toomey's making the point, as he does here with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell, that we can actually honor our debt obligations without raising the debt ceiling.
If we never were to raise the debt limit, which I'm not advocating, but if we never raise the debt limit at all, the Treasury would still take in 70% of all the money they plan to spend in the form of tax revenue. The amount of money needed to service our debt is only 6% of our expenditures. So with more than 10 times the revenue needed to avoid a default, what Treasury Secretary is going to default on our debt? It will never happen.
Jim, this obviously flies against some of the conventional wisdom thrown out there by the media, certainly the Democrats, and even a lot of Republicans who are kind of squeamish about not doing anything with the debt ceiling. But Pat Toomey definitely putting down a strong marker there, and I think that's going to be even more helpful for conservatives as we try to negotiate this thing, which it's clear that the Democrats have no interest in budging, at least yet.
Yeah, by the way, Greg, I'll know. This is probably one of those days we're discussing this topic. So you really wish you had Kevin Williamson instead of me, since he obviously, you know, follows these issues backwards and forwards. I do like the way yesterday he had, you know, Austin Goolsbee was one of the folks who was saying, you know, if we hit the ceiling, the world explodes, the sun crashes into the earth, cats and dogs living together, et cetera. And what he did was he literally, you know, he literally compared them to these other group that's saying the world is going to end on May 21st, I think. I don't know if you've seen those billboards all around, but I've seen trucks driving around D.C. saying the world ends on May 21st. I'm bummed about that, if true, Greg, because there are a lot of good movies coming out this summer I wanted to see. But so, you know, it does sound this strange apocalyptic you know, rhetoric we get from Geithner and other administration folks. And you notice that the date actually keeps changing. And it always is like, oh, you know, if we don't, they'll default and it'll be fiscal Armageddon. And then, of course, you know, like, well, okay, a couple more days later, May, June, July, definitely is what, you know. So when you see that hedging, you start saying, well, wait a second, you know, there's got to be some way that we can at least, you know, if there's got to be some wiggle room. And then, you know, I think what Toomey's perception is, you know, let's pay down the debt first and then see what we have left over and then start cutting from there. I just kind of wish that the Pat Toomey's of the world could get as much attention as the Donald Trump's of the world. And I don't know if it requires a new haircut on Toomey's part or what it's going to be. But I mean, in other words, this is, you know, people say, oh, why can't, you know, politicians solve problems? Well, here's Pat Toomey with a serious idea, serious proposal. The math adds up. He's also taken a much better, you know, debt reduction proposal. And, you know, he is by, you know, nowhere near as well known as many other Republicans. And I kind of wish that I also wish I knew a bit more. And again, this is, you know, one of those days where you typically sub in Kevin Williamson. So I'm sure at some point on the Exchequer blog in NRO, there'll be a lot more on this. So check with him. I'm just going to have a general rah-rah for Pat Toomey, which is, you know, habit for me.
On to item number two, martini number two now. And this is centered in your adopted home state of South Carolina now, Jim. And I know you're an expert on all things South Carolina as a result of your frequent travels to Hilton Head. And Boeing, of course, based up in the Pacific Northwest, making the Dreamliner, the largest airplane in the world, wants to set up a new facility in South Carolina. It had been doing so for years, hired 1,000 people, spent oodles of money on all sorts of new facilities. And then just a few months before they're set to open, the National Labor Relations Board comes in and says, you can't do that. This is a right-to-work state. This will give you leverage in any sort of union negotiations you have in other states, even though Boeing is not at all curtailing its workforce in Washington State. So just the latest in the union fights that we've been seeing. And the latest to weigh in on this, of course, is the ever-intelligent Harry Reid.
We all know that Republicans dislike organized labor. We know they disdain unions because unions demand fairness and equality from the big businesses Republicans so often shield at all costs.
You know, and once again, we should use our traditional slogan, way to go, Nevada, way to go. Would Sharon Engel really have been that bad? It's worth noting as we look at this that traditionally the entire purpose of the National Labor Relations Board is to, you know, attempt to bring some semblance of peace, some semblance of compromise between businesses and unions. And for a long time, the public believed that unions were, by and large, a good thing. I think you can look at the big three automakers and you can look at Detroit and really question that right now. That obviously, we don't want to go back to the days of the robber barons and the idea of terrible, you know, child labor, et cetera. But there's a strong argument to be made that they have very unrealistic expectations about wages, about benefits, about the kind of working deals that they can get and with have their the company continue to function as a whole. The argument, I believe it was one auto executive who said, really, we're a health insurance company that produces cars on the side. We're a pension administration company that just, you know, makes car autos are a byproduct. When you reach that point, that generally is a sign you've reached a environment in which businesses cannot thrive. They cannot prosper. They cannot grow. And thus, you end up with a slow and sluggish economy. So unsurprisingly, you know, for years we've seen companies moving from these rust belt states, the Northeast and Midwest, heading further down to the South. Some argue would say this is a partially climate matter of not having to pay for heating costs in the winter, but also very largely because these were largely right-to-work states. And it was much easier to set up businesses and much easier to get these things because you didn't have some union demanding more every step of the way and threatening to, you know, shut everything down if they didn't get their way. Well, here's the National Labor Relations Board just stepping right in and saying, yeah, we're just not going to let you move. And this is, you know, dramatically overstepping the traditional role of this organization. Nikki Haley is, you know, spitting nails over this, I think quite deservedly so. She wants every Republican who's going to campaign in South Carolina to weigh in on this. And I think it's pretty clear the way most Republican presidential candidates are going to weigh in on this. In the vision of Harry Reid and I assume Barack Obama, I don't think he's explicitly weighed in, but certainly this is what everything we know about him would suggest he believes, companies should not have the right to relocate from non-right-to-work states to right-to-work states. And if that's the case, this is a dramatic change in the way this country has operated. I think any semblance of being in the free market would be completely obliterated. And that would be the end of formation of companies in these heavily unionized states because you'd never be allowed to move. You'd never be allowed to go out to, you know, relocate to places where labor costs are cheaper. And, you know, even though workers may not like it, certainly companies have that right to say, hey, you know what? I can, you know, have a more efficient operation by going over to that place.
On to number three now, Jim. And we should let our listeners know that we thought about using this issue yesterday. And we said, now let's see how much the liberal media establishment runs with this. Well, thank you, Chris Matthews of Hardball, because we were discussing this story yesterday, this AP poll trying to do a survey of the president's popularity in the wake of the Bin Laden killing. And lo and behold, the issue was 60% now approve of the job the president is doing. However, as Jim reported in the Morning Jolt and as he has reported in Campaign Spot, there's a 17% skew towards Democrats. But you wouldn't hear that if you listen to this little clip from Wednesday night's Hardball.
And I guess the country's pretty proud of the president right now. A new Associated Press poll right now has the president's approval rating skyrocketing up to 60%. That's 6-0, Gene. That's high.
Shocking, Jim, that Chris Matthews would go ahead and talk about the 60% without talking about the skewed sample before that poll.
You know, all day yesterday, Greg, you know, I posted that early in the day. Obviously got a big reaction from regular NRO readers and then Drudge linked to it. And that brought in obviously to a much wider audience, which is always great when that happens. Clearly not a wide enough audience, certainly not to the media folk, because I got a haircut yesterday and the local DC news channel was mentioning this AP poll completely uncritically. And then while I was exercising yesterday, I caught the end of Hardball in which, you know, Matthews was still, you know, raving about it. And then the beginning of the it was the Jink Unger show, the, you know, that other guy. And he basically his response to the poll basically was reminiscent of Meg Ryan in When Harry Met Sally at the diner scene. Great enthusiasm, clutching the desk, trying to hold in his excitement. Now, as I said, this is a really big, you know, this sample has an awful lot of Democrats in it. Now, there are a couple of people commenting on the site who have said, oh, it should be even or something. My sense is the absolute, it's a poll of adults, and some people will complain about that. Now, I think this you can make an argument that, look, when it comes, you don't have to be a registered voter or a likely voter to have an opinion on the president. Certainly, if we're going to look at a head-to-head matchup, we should be looking at likely voters. And the more you focus in on who's actually going to vote, generally the better Republicans do. The broader your sample, the more likely you include people who aren't going to vote, generally the better Democrats do. There are a lot of you know, nominal Democrats out there who don't really pay that much attention to stuff, perhaps not unsurprising to our audience. The second thing is, so what should the partisan split be? Well, in terms of exit polls, people who we know to show up, the best it's been for Republicans has been roughly dead even, and the best it's been for Democrats in recent memory was 7 percentage points on Election Day 2008. So to me, it should be somewhere in that range, and if it's outside of that range, I get a little bit wary of it. Now, it's possible that killing Osama bin Laden made some more people identify as Democrats. They see good news for the Democrats and say, oh, I'm a Democrat today. But I don't think it is at this 46% to 29% split. I kind of am a little irked that nobody in AP looked at that sample and said, does that look right? Does that match up with what we know, that this is a country that's nearly half Democrat and less than a third Republicans? Because to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It certainly doesn't match what you find in the Gallup sample, in the Rasmussen sample, in the Reuters sample, and in the Pew sample. So to me, that thinks, okay, this is just a sample that is off base and just has way too many Democrats into it. And I'd like to see someday a pollster say, you know what, I just don't like this sample. It just doesn't smell right. I'm going to do it again. Unfortunately, I guess that would mean, you know, greater cost. And some would argue the AP found the result they wanted to see and have no problem putting it out there. And lo and behold, the new media narrative is that Barack Obama is the most hunky-dory popular president ever, and his reelection is guaranteed, yada, yada, yada. I guess, you know, that's what we get, I guess, for watching MSNBC.
Yeah, well, even with all that rosy projections, the polls still show that his approval on the economy is in the tank. So I think that's the one we got to watch long-term, not the one that might ebb and flow with specific headlines. But we'll keep watching, obviously. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.